Hello, and welcome to the Preview Spotlight Interviews on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer.
And I'm Bob Bretall. In this episode, we'll be talking with creators about upcoming projects available in the current month's previews catalog.
Now talking to Chris Roberson, who is writing a very cool book for IDW starting this month, and it is Star Trek and the Legion of Superheroes, or Star Trek / Legion of Superheroes number one. Thanks for joining me, Chris.
Happy to be here.
So we previously talked, you kind of gave us your pedigree on Michael Moorcock and other stuff, but you've got a huge pedigree with both Star Trek and Legion of Superheroes as well. Let's talk about that first, and then we'll move into a little bit of high-level stuff about how you're going to manage to get these groups meeting each other.
Well, the reality is that not only am I a giant geek and a fan of things, but I'm an obsessive fan. So pretty much everything that I have become a fan of over the years, I would just obsess over and find out everything I could. And Star Trek, the original, the classic Trek, and then, of course, the later stuff, too. But classic Trek and Legion of Superheroes were two of the things that I obsessed about very early, like by the age of 9, and never really let go of. So my bona fides for Star Trek are the let's see, I was a card-carrying member of the Starfleet fan club in the 1980s. In the 1990s, I was a card-carrying member of the Klingon Language Institute. I own, Hamlet's Shakespeare in the original Klingon from the original limited edition that the Klingon Language Institute did before it got too popular. For the Legion, the main thing is my party trick is I can name the real name and home planet of every member of the Legion of Superheroes. I was a member for a while of the Apple-ish. It was an amateur press association, Legion of Superheroes fan club in the late 80s, early 90s, that was run by Tom and Mary Birnbaum, who were at that time writing the Legion with Keith Giffen. I'm a huge, huge obsessive geek about those two things.
Okay, so we've got the original crew, Kirk, Spock, McCoy, those guys,
mm-hmm.
meeting up with the Legion. So how exactly are you making that happen?
Well, when first approached about the idea, as I've said a couple times before, I thought it was a prank because it's just too perfectly keyed to what I was obsessed with when I was a kid. I was super obsessed with Superman when I was 6, but by the time I was 9, it'd been eclipsed by Star Trek and Legion. I didn't want to screw it up, so I played along by email, at the same time calling everybody I knew that had done any work for IDW and accusing them of setting up this prank. As I'm, trying to figure out how you would make this work, corresponding back and forth with Chris Ryle, who's the editor-in-chief at IDW, who's overseeing this project. Very quickly, I figured out that there's a lot of points of congruence between the original Star Trek and Legion. Most notably, they're both optimistic futures. They're both stories with ensemble cast set in a distant but understandable future, where humanity has overcome our own problems. We haven't destroyed ourselves with an atomic Armageddon or a germ warfare or something. We've gone out into the galaxy. We've met other aliens. We've made friends with some of them. Some of them become intractable enemies. And we become the cornerstone of a federation of planets that then sends representatives together to help secure and maintain and protect that federation. So they're actually on paper pretty similar. When you go so far as to look at the fact that in the 1970s, the Legion cruiser, the spaceships that the Legion of Superheroes tooled around in, was essentially the Enterprise. I mean, it was actually the Enterprise with little bits of the old Klingon battle cruisers from the original series. It kind of started to make a lot more sense. And so when it came time to figure out like how the story would work, what we did was we picked a handful of Legionnaires who would make sense placed alongside Kirk and company, so that like their power sets weren't things that would appear ridiculous or stretch the bounds of credibility. So that like in the Star Trek world, they've dealt with aliens that are you know, purely intelligent energy or have telepathic powers or can you know, do crazy teleportation stuff or rewrite reality around them. So having somebody that can you know, bend magnetism or generate electricity isn't that crazy. It kind of made sense. Now, of course, I very quickly discovered that I was limited to six when I realized that a Constitution-class starship has only six transporter pads in the main transporter room. So there could only be six crew members, including Uhura, from the Enterprise who get caught up in this kind of transporter accident and then subsequently end up in a different universe, a different version of Earth. And so we could only have six Legionnaires in a time bubble that goes through a similar kind of mishap and crash lands in the same alternate universe.
So looking at the cover of the first one, yeah, we see the seven classic crew members. So one of these is going to not be involved in the crossover story.
I'm sorry to say that Scotty gets left behind.
Well, he's got to take care of the ship.
Yeah.
Now, there's only five Legionnaires on the cover. We've got Lightning Lad, Saturn Girl, Cosmic Boy, Chameleon
Boy
and...
Shadowless. The one that's missing is Brainiac 5, who's actually on the variant cover.
Oh, that's right. And he'll be cool with Spock, right?
That was one of the first pairings that occurred to me. Not only because they're both like the smart guy, who knows technology and knows science, but that they're both from planets where the inhabitants have green blood and are dedicated to logic. So,
right, and they
natural.
Don't have a lot of overt emotion going on. Yeah. And yeah, there's a lot of similarities there. That's right. So we're going to have this accident that's going to happen. We're going to throw these groups together, and then there's going to be some kind of point of contention, one would imagine, aside from just getting home.
Well, what they quickly discover, at first they think it's just an accident that's tossed them into another parallel universe, kind of a mirror-mirror situation. But they eventually discover that, in fact, that's not quite what's happened. But the reality of the situation is that something has changed history such that thousands upon thousands of years in the past, an event happened that caused neither of their histories to come into being. So that, like, you know, as you know, all these worlds are kind of branching off from each other and becoming the different parallel worlds of the multiverse, there's a shared point where the Star Trek universe and the Legion of Superheroes universe, the DC universe, were the same, and then they split and became two different universes and followed divergent paths. So something has happened to change the past so that split didn't occur, but instead a third new universe, new history, came into being that blends elements of both.
Okay, cool.
So they can't actually just recreate the experiment and go home, because home's not there anymore. What they have to do is find out what changed history and fix it, or this new world they're in will be the only one that there is.
How many issues is the series?
Six.
Six issues. Okay. Very cool. Now, you're working with Jeff Moy on this, mm-hmm. who has done some Legion stuff before.
And Star Trek, I'd forgotten. Yeah.
Oh, what Star Trek has he done?
I don't remember, actually, but it was pointed out to me because I kept talking about how he had such a great pedigree doing the Legion stuff. And then it was pointed out to me that he'd done some Star Trek stuff, I believe, when DC had the license back in the 90s. So he's done both.
Very good. So what's it like working with him?
Well, his brother, Philip, is doing the inks. And what's great is that those are two guys that know these franchises well. At first I was supplying lots and lots of visual reference for, you know, this is what a Klingon cruiser looks like, or this is what, you know, the Organians look like. And very quickly I discovered that I could just say, this is a Mark II phaser rifle, and they would draw it. They knew what that meant. And also they've just been very, they've been very careful and attentive with, like, if they see, you know, a better way to do the layouts, or they think a bit of staging could be tweaked to make it play out better. You know, they're are not content to just sit back and take a paycheck and do the work. They're really invested in making it as good as it can be. So it's been great.
Very good. I just did a quick look up while you were talking there. It looks like Philip did inks on Star Trek First Contact adaptation.
Okay.
From Marvel/Paramount. And then they both did a Star Trek Voyager OGN back in 2000 called False Colors.
Well, that would have been Malibu. Malibu would have gone by then. I don't know who was doing Voyager back then.
Let's take a quick look. That was by Wildstorm.
Okay. So what it was, ultimately DC kind of.
Yes. But not the original crew guys. So so this will be a good chance for them to do that. You know, that's kind of cool when you get people that are fans of the stuff also, so that you can speak in a little bit of shorthand and you don't have to, you know, dig up a lot of reference and stuff, and everything will look like it's supposed to look.
Well, honestly, you know, this is my first, along with the creator-owned book I'm doing with IDW, experience working with IDW. And I think that one of the things they do that's really smart is they get these franchises, and then they find working professionals who are already fans of that thing, and then have them do it. They've done that with, I mean, most notably, in my experience, with the Doctor Who stuff, where they find the people who are the biggest Doctor Who fanatics they can find, and then let them loose to do cool stuff.
And that's a smart thing to do, because, you know, when you're a fan of something, I mean, even when you're an amateur fan, like, you know, myself or a lot of the people listening, you know, you always kind of have these thoughts about, oh, wouldn't it be cool if, you know, and then when you couple that with someone who's actually a professional writer or artist, where they can take that, wouldn't it be cool if, and just spin out some really neat stories, you know, to expand on the franchise. That's magic.
Well, I mean, it's the exact same thought process in our heads. So the thing that motivates me, both in coming up with the original, the basic idea, the outset, but also when doing every issue, is exactly that same kind of fanish impulse that I had when I was 9, you know, making up adventures for, you know, Kirk and company. They're paying me to do it, as opposed to just, you know, doing it instead of paying attention in math class.
So, shifting away from that, I want to talk about some of the other stuff that you're doing right now. You just finished up a run on the Cinderella series, and John and I, you know, we both loved that. We just reviewed issue 6 and kind of reviewed the whole series, and, you know, big thumbs up from both of us on that.
Thank you.
We were curious if in this New Fables miniseries, it was kind of hinted at the Fables panel in San Diego, that after the initial story arc, at some point there would be some Cinderella arcs.
Yeah.
And they'd love to get you guys doing some Cinderella arcs. Are there any plans on, you know, when we might be seeing that, or how frequently we might be seeing Cinderella in that?
I can answer one of those, and I don't have an answer for the other. The reason it seemed like it was a hint is that Willingham is just very imprecise in his use of language. In fact, there are definitive plans. Sean McManus and I are doing a six-issue Cinderella arc for Ferris that will essentially be like the third miniseries, but folded into the Ferris ongoing. As to when it's going to come out, I think they're talking about it being the fourth arc, so it would be a little ways down the line. But, you know, we've already done most of the prep work for it and figured out what the plot would be. And so it's really just a question of getting it on the schedule and getting it done. But it's really a question now of when, not if. So you'll definitely be seeing more Cinderella written by me and drawn by Sean.
Oh, very good. You know, we both are big fans of just that take where she's, you know, kind of a spy. Not even kind of. She is a spy, but, you know, it's kind of undercover spy because, you know, she runs the shoe store and stuff, so.
Well, this time out, we, you know, spoiler warning, it's at least 2 years out, but we're sending her to China, and she's going to be messing around with a bunch of Chinese fables. And we'll find out that the title originally was going to be, when it was a standalone miniseries, Cinderella, the Fable Who Loved Me. That may still be the subtitle, but we're going to find out who Cinderella's ex-boyfriend is.
Okay, cool. So, still little takes on James Bond.
Oh, definitely.
Titles.
Eventually, we will run out of James Bond titles to riff on.
You got a ways to go for that to happen.
We'll figure something else out.
Very good. So you're also wrapping up on the first arc of, or I hope it's the first arc and there'll be more of the book in the Stan Leeverse.
Uh-huh.
Over at Boom Studios. Anything that you can say about whether there's going to be more Starborn down the line?
I probably can't say.
Okay. I'll bless you for it.
Yeah. I'm writing it right now. That's all I know. I just know what they tell me.
Yeah. So, moving on from that, how you are doing a new creator-owned series called Memorial that will be coming along in, another 6 months or so.
Yeah, February of next year.
So, early days, what's the basic high-level concept there?
On a bumper sticker, it's Doctor Who meets Sandman by way of Miyazaki with a talking cat.
Okay.
There'll be a 10-page preview that'll be, I think it's in the October IDW titles. I know it's going to be in Lock and Key in October, and maybe elsewhere. In a sentence, it's a story of a girl who appears one day at a hospital with complete amnesia, having no memory whatsoever, who she is or where she's from. A year later, she's rebuilt her life, and through misadventure, she inherits a magic wandering shop, you know, the kind that appears at the end of an alleyway. You didn't know it was there before. You go, you buy a gremlin or a cursed monkey's paw, and when you go to return the thing, it's not there anymore. The store has disappeared. So she inherits that store, and when it disappears, she goes with it. And the story is about what happens next.
Okay, cool. You're still doing Elric. Issue 2 just came out, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
You're also doing iZombie. Anything? I mean, Elric just started up. We talked about that one, so we're still in the initial story there, or the story of The Balance Lost. Anything cool coming up in iZombie?
Well, of course. It's cool every month. We're just wrapping up the third storyline. Where everything gets broken, all the very meticulously crafted character relationships and scenarios that we spent a year establishing are all getting knocked over. And then the fourth story arc starts up. It's been solicited, not yet. So in October, I believe, is a fill-in issue. It's written by me, drawn by Jay Stevens of Land of Nod fame and Atomic City Tales, probably better known to the broader audience as the guy who came out, who created Tuttenstein, which was a TV show for a while, or Secret Saturdays, or Jet Cat, a number of things. anyway, that's a look back at the first mission of the grizzled veteran Diogenes back in the 80s when he went up against the Vampire Queen of the Amazon. And then we start the fourth story arc in which Gwen has to fulfill the last wish of a dead hippie and follow an aging jam band from the 70s across the country on their final reunion farewell tour and solve mysteries along the way.
That'll teach her to eat a hippie's brain.
I know, I know. She should really be more discriminating.
Very good. So it looks like you've got a decent amount of stuff coming up to keep us entertained. I am definitely looking forward to Star Trek Legion of Superheroes coming out from IDW. Make sure, everyone, that this is a book that, especially DC fans who don't normally buy IDW books, you know, sometimes those comic shop owners don't pay attention to the IDW section as much as they do to the DC section. So you want that book, make sure you tell your comic shop to order it for you.
I just picked up previews today, and I was yesterday. I was gratified to see that it was one of Diamond's gems of the month.
Cool.
So hopefully more people will notice it.
Very good. Well, thank you for taking the time with me, Chris.
Always.
As always. And looking forward to all your work.
Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
Now I'm talking to Dave Ryan, who's got a product that's been a long time in the making in the August previews catalog, War of the Independents. Thanks for joining me, Dave.
Hey, Bob. Good to hear from you again.
Let's talk about the general concept of War of the Independents.
Well, let me see if I can recall. back in like about 2005 or so, I remember, I think it was about the time of the crisis ended, the second crisis ended for DC, and Civil War was just coming out. And it just seemed to me that it was just never ending, all these events, and Lord knows they have not slowed down at all since. But, and with all the tie-ins, it was just flooding the market and making the indie market smaller and smaller. So I kicked around an idea to a couple people, and I started putting it together. I didn't even have the title for about a good year or so. But I called up a good friend of mine from a long time ago, Bill Tucci, and a few of my closer friends, and they said, sure. And, you know, it has snowballed out of control to I have almost every single guy in there now. So, it's been an adventure. Now, we got it all together. We did the Kickstarter, which you're well aware of. That was a great success. We got the book out for a couple preview copies out for New York Comic Con with two different covers. And now we're solicited in August, so with an October release.
So this is a great book for fans of independent comics. I mean, it's almost a who's who of indie comics that have come out not only recently, but for a while in the past. I mean, I'm looking at the cover here, who can I name here? I'm starting in the upper left-hand corner. Unfortunately, the first one in the upper left-hand corner, I'm not really sure who the girl in the red, white, and blue is.
That would be Ms. Victory from Femforce.
Okay, great. And then
I'm going to do this from memory, so you just go.
I got too much coffee, man. I've got E-Man, Joe Staton's E-Man. I've got Atomica.
Yeah.
Then I've got a guy with a black and white costume. His chest is white, and he's got a black cowl. Not exactly sure who that is.
All right, now you're going to go make me look at the book.
And I'll keep on going while you do that. I got Zot. I've got what looks like Mercy Sparks.
That's her.
Cassie and Vlad from Hack Slash.
Mm-hmm.
I've got Mario Gully's The Ant. I've got Neera X. I've got some kind of robot flying up there. I'm not exactly sure who that is.
Well, that would be Cyberfrog. Ethan Van Sciver's Cyberfrog.
Ethan Van Sciver's first creation.
Right. Gotta have
it. Zipping back the other direction, I've got, what is that, Zippy the Pinhead. I don't know who the guy is next to Zippy. Then I got Usagi Yojimbo.
Let's see here. Guy with the hood. Oh, with the his one arm was on fire and one arm was ice?
Yes.
That's Todd Nook's freezer burn from Wild Guard.
Okay. And who's the guy to the left of Zippy the Pinhead?
With his hat on backwards there? That's Chuck D from Public Enemy.
Okay, and is that...
Flavor
Flav next to him? Okay.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, then I got Usagi Yojimbo. I think that's the 10th Muse.
Yep.
Scud the Disposable Assassin, Captain Action, Mr. Monster, Madman, Billy Tucci Shee, Reed Fleming, World's Toughest Milkman.
Excellent, excellent.
Don't know who this guy is that Reed is jumping out from behind this big guy.
That would be actually me from my book Penance. I'll send you a copy of that, sir.
Okay, and then I got Gumby and Pokey. I got the Tick.
That is also in front of her. That woman right there is Xenia.
Who is that again?
Xenia.
Okay.
It was a book from the early 90s I worked on.
Okay, and then I got Faust. I've got Bone. I've got the Pro. Mr. Monster, Captain Canuck, Bomb Queen, Zen Intergalactic Ninja, Badger, Cerebus, The Max, Milk and Cheese, Cave Woman, Megaton Man, Flaming Carrot, and then the guy who's between Cave Woman and Flaming Carrot. I don't know who that is.
You're not going to think of that one. That's Barry Blair, who passed away a few years ago. That's his Gun Fury.
Okay. I did pretty good, though.
That was impressive. That was pretty good. Yes, you're on staff.
That is a lot of characters. I mean, I didn't know maybe five of them.
Yeah, that was pretty good. That's much better than a lot of people. Most people do, but yeah.
So tell us about the story. I mean, we've obviously got a boatload of. Without spoiling it, you know, but we've got a ton of all these different indie characters from all different creators, and we're going to bring them together.
Yeah, it follows a similar story path plot as the first Crisis with George Pérez did. It's sort of just gathering heroes from all different universes, worlds, to fight these villains who are creating this gateway to let the main villain, Razorjack, into our world. So that's basically how it goes. And it's a six-issue story arc, and actually it's going to be a continuing series. But after the six issues, everyone signed up for six issues will have different smaller stories with different characters and smaller stories. But that's basically the gist of it. And actually the six... After the sixth issue was out, then we'll do the graphic novel, and the graphic novel will have an extra issue in it, sort of an issue seven, and it'll be a little bonus, plus for you to pick up the graphic novel, which, you know, I'm always either way, you know, if I just have the issues, I'm not going to buy the graphic novel, but if I have an extra issue in it, something that'll entice me to, you know, grab that, I will. So I thought that'd be an extra bonus for anybody.
So as we're going along through this, how does it actually work on, I mean, we've got all these different characters in here. Are the individual creators just saying, hey, go ahead and use my character for this thing, or do you have to give every guy like a penny or something for, you know, each panel that these guys are in? Or
No.
What's the deal?
No penny. I have a little form I had, which I've been signed off on it, and if it's something, really that's going to be inclusive of their character, I'm not changing anybody's past, I'm not killing anybody or, you know, anything like that, but, you know, I basically show them the artwork, and I write a general plot, and I'll write the story up, and then I'll give them the dialogue, and if they want to change it to their characters, you know, to their personality, or, you know, to put their two cents in, I want to make it as... you know, as home base as possible for everybody. I don't want anybody to look at, you know, what Bone is saying and saying, oh, that's not what Bone would really say. You know, so I did a ton of research, and I'm trying to keep it as true as possible, you know, as authentic for the indie readers. So that's really what indie readers are.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking through the book, and there's like even more characters in here that weren't even on the cover. I mean, there are so many different. That's a fraction of the characters that are in there.
They asked me in the Diamond write-up, how many do you have in here? Like, there's like 150. I said, there's about 100 or so creators. And then you've got, you know, like just Mark Ellis's Justice Machine is in there, and he's got like 7 characters. So I said, I really haven't sat down and did a total count of all the characters in there. And Ben Edlund gave me Tick, but he gave me print size. He said, Tick, whoever you want to use in the Tick. So, you know, there's a gigantic universe.
Right. I mean, yeah, you get like American Maid and Arthur and Manny. Oh,
Arthur.
Cow,
you can expect to see Arthur.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So I broke it up into different, after the first issue, I broke it up into different categories. Issue 2 happens to be all the bros. It was from a pitch I made for years ago with the Avengers. I had a whole African-American team of Avengers, and I pitched it up to Marvel, and they loved it, but they had to turn it down for whatever reasons. But so I included in this in the second issue. The third issue is sort of all the Supermen. The fourth issue is all the women on Amazon Island that go off on. The fifth issue, which is my personal favorite, is all the cartoon characters together. Milk and Cheese, Cerebus Bone, Tick, Flaming Carrot. They go off on a crazy hijinks adventure. And number 6 is really it'll be a double-sized wrapper-upper. And the extra issue that will be in the graphic novel is all sort of the low-powered, non-powered heroes go off on an adventure in New York City. So it'll be like Mad Men, Mr. Monster, and those guys.
Well, I see Gearhead here.
Oh, yeah, Gearhead, yeah.
She's doesn't have power, so she'll be in there.
Well, she's in also, she'll be in the...
the women one, yeah. I see the living corpse here.
Oh, yeah, I'll tell you what's interesting, too, is when I first started putting this together back in 2005, some of these characters weren't even in books yet. Hack and Slash, Mercy Sparks. And to see them develop into, especially like Hack and Slash, I mean, it's huge now. And it was really good to see. So I just saw that there was like one sketch of them. And I asked him, what is that all about? And he was like, you know, give me the background and everything. And it was just great. It's been great. Bomb Queen. Bomb Queen wasn't even out yet. He just, Jimmy did a sketch of her. And I saw it and I was like, what is this? You know, this looks great. So, yeah, it's been great. It's really cool. You know, see Bomb Queen and the Pro in the same book is going to be interesting.
I think this is a must-have book for any fans of indie comics. It's just kind of a, like you said, I mean, it's essentially a who's who of independent comics.
And,
you know, just kind of looking through this and seeing it, I'm looking at the, I have the PDF of the first issue. It was one of the things that, you know, I got from supporting the Kickstarter campaign. And, you know, just the copyright info. You got so much. It's like a full page.
Yeah, it totally is. Yeah. And there's the Max, you know, John Gallagher's Buzz Boy. Morpheus's Jet is in there.
Yeah. Well, you got everybody in here.
Darkman, you know.
I think, you know, as much as I'm looking forward to issue 1, I'm looking forward to these other issues also that have the themes where you'll be able to focus in and have, you know, less than 100, 150 people running around.
Yeah. I know. That's the whole thing. The first issue is like, you have to make it not turn out to be a cluster bang up. It's got to be, it's a tough thing to put together, especially when a lot of people don't know the characters, a lot of the characters.
Right.
So, you know, just write some sort of cohesive thing. I mean, you're not going to write winning the literary awards writing that first issue. So it's just get them together. Issue 2 is all finished. It's being colored right now by Wilson Ramos Jr. I plotted the whole thing. I sort of did it the old Marvel way. I drew plotted the whole thing. I drew it out. I'm taking it to Al Simmons. He's actually has a character in that Blackjack. He's a writer at Archie, famous writer, and he's doing the script with me, and there's the artist Mashindu who's doing the cover of number two. So but, I can't wait for it. He's an amazing artist. If you haven't seen the stuff.
So now that you've got the successful Kickstarter campaign, that was enough to finance the six issues that'll go up through the trade?
Absolutely not. No, that
that was for issue one.
That was for issue one. Yeah. Well, I don't I don't like to do anything like offer someone a piece of the back end or anything like that. So I had Wilson color the book and letter the book, and I paid him up front for it. So
right.
Well, I paid him as he finished it. And then, of course, the printing, too. So that took care of the 2,200 books we printed up for New York Comic Con.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest, the rest we can deal with as it comes in. And we'll get the orders from number one and then, deal with the I'm still on the fence of who exactly I'm going to deal with the printer. Printer wise here, so it was different when I did my own book back in 2000 called Penance through Red Anvil also, and I was dealing with Quebecor in Canada at the time, and they had a little hookup with Diamond where Diamond paid them directly, so you didn't have to put nothing up front, and they just paid them, and they were guaranteed their money, which is a good way to work. You don't have to put anything up front, and but now we'll see what the printers are going to deal with. I'd like to keep it in the U.S., get a U.S. printer. I'm all for supporting local businesses and stuff rather than going overseas. China, you got to ship it and everything.
Right.
So, which is what we did with the first issue. So, but it'd be hard to beat the price, but we'll try.
Very good. So, everyone, this is absolutely a book that you should love if you're a fan of indie comics. And it's also the exact kind of book that most comic shops are not going to order unless you go to that comic shop and tell them, please order this comic
right.
book for me. So, go out. It's in under a Red Anvil. Publishing in the back half of previews. Make sure you let your comic shop know what this is and how cool it is, because I think a lot of comic shops, especially comic shops that stock and support indie comics, will get copies of this book. They just have to know about it, and that's the real trick, because something's in the back of previews. They don't always see it. So remind your store. Hey, you got War of the Independence. It's got 150 plus different indie characters that have been coming out over the last 20, 25 years. And this is a great comic for anyone to support and try out. So do what you can and go ask your shop about it.
I appreciate that, Bob. It just reminded me of when Marcosia changed her name to, Triple A Marcosia?
Yeah, AAM Marcosia, something like that, to get up near the front.
You know what's interesting, too? I have to tell you, I just did the Big Apple Comic Con, which is very good. You have kids and, parents come on, they're just walking. Well, Sunday was the kids' day, which is great. I love when they have the kids dress up and everything. But they come around, they look at the book, and you'd be surprised. No kid knows who Gumby is. They know Bone from Scholastic, but nobody knows Gumby. And it's interesting because you see, like, all the characters come out at different times. Mr. Monster, I believe, was 1941 when it originally came out. You have the Badger, Faust. All the certain years that characters got Zippy the Pinhead from the 60s. So it's interesting. To see who knows what, who knows what. Mostly everyone knows the Tick, remember, from the cartoon, but that's a certain age bracket, too.
Right.
But, there's certain characters I would love to work on. When I first contacted Mike Barron, he asked me if I would do Badger, if I draw the Badger. And I said, oh, I'd love to do that. You know, I'd love to, but I can't just drop this project and draw the Badger. You know, that was tough for me. It was one of my favorite characters. So it's going to be a lot of fun. I mean, combining these characters together and keeping them true. I mean, my indie collection of books now might give your room a run for the money.
So, well, I'll tell you, every one of those characters that I knew who they were,
right.
I've got their comics.
Excellent. Excellent.
Those are in my collection.
It was good to see when that Scud finished up. And, unfortunately, too, like I was saying about Gun Fury with...
I remember seeing that. He did that Barry Blair, I think you said. Mm-hmm. Didn't he do, like, Elf Lord or something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, oh, he had
like
a lot of
Air
stuff.
Cell
yeah.
Back yeah, he, in the 90s.
Yeah, he does. He's done a lot of comics. And, you know, poor Barry, I would talk to him online, and he went to the doctor for an earache, and it wound up, they gave him some drops, and he went home and had it was an aneurysm.
Oh, wow.
It's terrible. You know, and throughout this thing, unfortunately, we've had the same thing happen a few times. I had Thunder Agents in here. And when he passed away, and then DC picked him up. You know, I contacted DC, and, you know, they asked if I could take them out because they had their own plans with them, even though I had the contract. So I took them out. Mike Waringo's Telos was in this. Let's see, Poison Elves was the, what was his name?
Drew Hayes.
Yeah, Drew was the first guy who passed away, actually. His characters were in this. And, you know, it's... I kept Barry's character. The other guys, I felt, you know, kind of... Yeah, it just didn't feel right for me to put the guys from Telos right. and those guys in there for me. Just years ago with your gut feeling. But Barry was so into it and everything all the time, and supportive of my artwork and stuff, so... And I absolutely... It was a serious Gun Fury I had. I think it came out when I was in high school, back in the 80s, and I ate every single issue of it. It was black and white, it was cheesy, it was great. I loved it. You know, it was a... He's about the only one in there who stayed in after the creator passed away, unfortunately. So we'll see. We're going to pump it up. We're going to see if we can get to make a dent in the percentile there of the DC Marvel wall there. So we'll see.
I'd like to just at least see, you know, people... knowing who some of these characters are, you know, that would be a great thing too, you know.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I mean, you know, you have so many fans, you just have to get it out there, and to, which is another good thing that this took so long to get out, is it made the people a little more aware of it out there. And, you know, if we can get fans from, just a couple percentage of the fans from all these different fans of characters, then we might be able to do pretty well. Because I'd like to keep going with this thing and enjoy myself beyond the madness that it was to put this first one together. So we shall see, my friend.
Oh no, that it's a great thing. You know, I think one thing I'll throw a suggestion out for the trade anyway is I always love when you have, you know, especially when you have these giant who's who panels like you've got in here. And like a key to that, you know, where you got
the
silhouettes and you say who they are. And, you know, actually nice is to, especially because you'll have room maybe in the trade, is to have some reference so that if somebody wants, you know, it's like you can say, like, when it was published, how many issues, you know, things like
that's
that.
That's a good idea for the trade, yeah.
You can dig these things up as back issues because a lot of these indies, you know, interestingly, you know, especially the ones that came out in the 90s, they printed more copies of those comics than, you know, some of the top-selling books today sell. You know,
oh well, that wouldn't be too hard.
Comics sold so much better back then.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you know, I was over in maybe 2 months ago over in Joe Koch's Brooklyn store. He's got a warehouse over there, literally. And I was in the back, and I was digging up old Captain Canucks and Faust issues. You know, I don't have this one. I took that one. You know, it's great, and there are so many. Like you said, there are so many copies out there. So you know, I'm excited to see how this grows and see where it goes to, you know. It is just getting the stores to look at it, you know, take a chance on it. And so we'll see, you know. I mean, we've been waiting for like 10 years or so for some sort of bounce back. And I don't know, it's creeping along. It's getting a little better. But, you know, I took a look at the numbers, and right, so I remember years ago with Marvel, Thor went down to about 84,000 copies, and it was thinking about canceling it. That's how low that was, that number back then.
Yeah, and you know, I think the first issue of the new series sold definitely less than that, and it was one of the top books.
You know? Yeah, I know. I was just taking a look at John's numbers he had up 2 days ago, and The Fear Itself did that. Was number one, I believe, right?
Yeah.
There's your crossover, so we'll see how it goes. I guess fingers crossed, and keep pushing it and do whatever you can for it. And,
we shall see. Absolutely. You know, we'll just keep talking about it, and again, everyone who's listening, go off and ask your shop to get some copies of this and give this one a try. It's a great way to get exposed to and support indie comics. Thanks for joining me, Dave.
Oh, it's great talking to you again, Bob, and I'm sure we will get together in San Diego.
Yep, very good.
And I will bring you your hard copies from New York.
Cool. Thanks a lot.
All right, my friend. Thanks a lot.
Hi everyone, it's Amber Love, and today I'm talking with Mike Raich from Third World Studios, and we are talking about his newest book called The Pack, which is in the previews for October. So welcome to the show, Mike.
Thanks, Amber. Cool to be
on. We will get into all of the details about The Pack, and starting off by the very basics is what we've got here is a werewolf horror story. Basically, werewolves that are infesting the town, or is it just going to be one werewolf? How are you handling
this? I think it's more of like, it kind of starts with a little bit of a murder mystery and who killed one of the students at the school, and then it kind of, like anything in high school, it spreads, like, you know, it's like a gossip, or even like, you know, if someone in the school had like an STD or something, and then they were hooking up with other people, this is the way things spread through schools, and just like that with kids with the STDs or something, this werewolf virus kind of spreads based on who comes in contact with who. And, you know, once the interesting thing about it is that each character kind of responds to being a werewolf differently, so they kind of, you know, if you were the geeky kid, would you go after a hot girl, or if you were the girl that liked a certain boy, you go after a certain boy. If you're angry at a certain person, you'd go after them when you're a werewolf. Like, just it affects everyone a different way the closer they get to the full moon. So that's kind of how it kind of spreads through town, and we get to find out who's been doing what and everything like that. So
that's a unique approach to amplify.
Yeah, STDs aren't the usual thing to talk about, but you know, but in a high school situation where kids are, you know, always kind of, you know, they're growing up together and getting, you know, they only have the small cliques to work through. They all kind of end up intermingling. So that's kind of how I always approached it.
Cool. And what was your inspiration for coming up with a werewolf story involving teenagers?
Well, I've always loved the horror stuff. I grew up in the 80s and early 90s, and I loved, you know, movies like Halloween and Lost Boys and things like that, you know, kind of took teens and put them in the horror situations. But I also loved, like, the John Hughes movies where we got to see, you know, like Breakfast Club, Pretty in Pink, things like that, where, you know, the high schoolers were treated really, really kind of truthfully, and like we were able to see the good and the bad of being a kid. I kind of wanted to play with that angle while like throwing in the werewolf angle. So I kind of was hoping to mix like a John Hughes type thing with the fun, you know, horror stuff that I liked as a kid. Okay. Even today, like with the Friday Night Lights thing where you get all the drama and everything, and the football, that's kind of what we try to do here, is like there's football involved and like there's a, you know, and then the werewolves. So it's kind of like Friday Night Lights with werewolves, or like a John Hughes film with werewolves that want to tear you apart. Like that's kind of what we're going for. And we kind of set it back in the back in the 90s as well to kind of get a little bit of that retro type vibe to it.
And let's see, so it's going to be three parts, right?
Yep, three parts.
And let's talk about the page count for each of these issues.
Sure. The first issue is, I believe, 31. Well, it's a 32-page book with 31 pages of story. And then the second issue, we're almost up to 40 pages. And then the third issue, we go back to 32. So it's kind of a, it's definitely, each issue is oversized with no ads, or very few ads. If there's an ad, it'll probably be an ad for, like, Stuff Legend or the next issue or something. So they're all, each one's oversized, which is nice. And Third World's always great that way. But they gave Daniel and I, my artist and I, a chance to, you know, tell the story the way we saw fit. So
if it does well, do you already have stories in mind for continuing beyond this, or are you not thinking that far ahead?
I think we could do more. I always kind of approach this as, like, you know, it could be the beginning of a, you know, horror movie type series, but it's also pretty, you know, there's an ending to this too. So the first three issues, if that's all you want to invest in, then I think that's cool. You know, it's got a good beginning, middle, and end, I think, that will satisfy the readers. But I think there's a way to play. There's always a way to play off something, especially in horror movies. So you can always come back. But hopefully people will like it enough that we can do more.
Okay. And, you know, since it is kind of like a small press book, we're talking with Third World Studios here, and it's going to actually be in color, not in black and white, like a lot of small press.
Yep. Just like Stuff of Legend, we wanted to do color. And although Daniel's art's beautiful, just black and white, I think we always want to do color just because we got the werewolves and, and there's a lot of gore and excitement and things like that. So
okay, so let's talk about Daniel. Where did you find him? What's his name completely? And
It's Daniel Fasciolongo, I believe. Honestly, Daniel and I have never spoken anything other than Facebook and over emails because I think he speaks a little bit of English, but not much. But he can write and respond to English, and I think he's got someone that helps him with that. But I actually got a hold of Daniel through Alberto Ponicelli, who I'd worked with when I was an editor at Marvel on a couple books. I was talking to him about a werewolf book I was thinking about doing, and he suggested Daniel for the art. And Daniel sent over some samples, and then they were amazing. And now I think they were Hellboy samples, which were really good. And now he's been working on this, and it's, you know, it's a part-time thing for him, so he's been working on it for about a year and a half or 2 years, and we're just about done with the third issue now. So he's doing it on the side, which is great, and it looks, every page gets better. He's really good. I'm excited for people to see it. So
that's great. It's a good shot for a new guy.
Oh, definitely. He's amazing. Definitely. Third World's great. Third World has some great artists that they worked with, like Charles and now Daniel, and, you know, even Brian Smith, my writing partner on Stuff of Legend, he's doing the scapegoat for them too. So, I mean, they always have some pretty amazing looking stuff coming.
Who would you say that Daniel's art resembles? Is there anybody that comes to mind that you can think
of? I don't know. I'm not sure. I guess I always have a hard time with that question because I always trying to think. Not really sure.
Whenever I see horror stuff, I immediately think of Josh Metters.
I think so. You know, there's definitely some. I mean, did you have any? Yeah, that's who you thought of when you saw.
That's
stuff?
Who I thought of. Yeah. I mean, it's a very more rough. Like, you could tell that he's early. It's just kind of like, you know, finding his groove.
Yeah, and there's definitely, as you go through the book, it's, what's amazing is by the time, it's all like consistent and everything, but like you can start to see where he's really, you know, because when we first started, we were talking about, and this is like for, you know, any beginning artist and things, we're talking about things with Daniel, like, you know, be careful with where you place, you know, leave room for word balloons, make sure this transition works, make sure things like this work, and now it's more like, we're up to the point where we're like, all right, let's try and shift the camera and play with this angle and, like, do different things. So it's been a lot of fun. I think he's had fun doing it, too. So it's kind of nice to be working with someone that's responding and happy and excited to do the book.
How involved were you in designing what the werewolf monsters or creatures actually looked like? Did you give him guidance on that, or did you just say it's a werewolf and let him take over?
I think he just designed the werewolf, and we were just like, awesome. So
okay.
I know we always kind of thought, like, I always love, I'm a bigger fan of werewolves that are, like, a little more jarring to look at, like the werewolves and maybe the Howling, which dates me a little bit. But like, things like the Howling or Dog Soldiers, where they're standing up and, like, you know, coming to get you, as opposed to maybe some of the more recent things where they end up just being wolves. I think, I don't know, I'm a bigger fan of, like, the real
I think in Underworlds, I think they were all upright as well.
Yeah, I mean, things like that. I think those types of, yeah. Like, I'm more of the upright. I like them to look creepy and kind of like, just like, you know, they should be scary.
And
I like that.
So. Yeah, they're. I mean, because they're definitely like, you've got some, they're fierce creatures, they're monsters,
yeah.
Which is a, you know, slightly different approach to some of the more pop styles of.
Right, yeah.
I
definitely wanted this to be more of a horror, you know, like more of a horror type book, you know. They're not pretty creatures.
They're not pretty. They're not just shirtless, pretty shiny boys.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's definitely a different, you know, and that, there's a place for all that and everything, I think, and there's definitely, but like this is like more like, this is definitely a grittier type look at that side of what becoming a monster.
Can you divulge the werewolf weaknesses and strengths without, you know, spoiling anything?
I think it's, they're pretty similar to the usual.
Okay.
I think maybe they're a little bit more, I think the one thing it affects is the way the people's passions and how they, you know, the closer they are to turning, the closer they are to things getting a little out of control, maybe, I think. You know, and I think I want to leave some surprises, but, you know, a lot of the usual werewolf things are still true here, like things with silver and different things like that. I like the legend. I like the feel of, like, the almost the mystical nature of some of the things like that. I think those work and make it, you know, it gives you something to it gives, you know, that's, you know, it gives you the silver bullet to do what you need to do with it, or it gives you that special weapon to kind of attack them and do things with, and it gives normal people a chance to defend themselves, you know. So
is there going to be one standout hero in the book, like one particular protagonist, like in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, like, you know, she's always going to be the main character even though she's very team focused?
Right, yeah, I think there's a team here. I think we get to know five or six characters really well, I think. There's David, who is kind of the nerdy kid, kind of a loner in school. There's Greg, who's the new kid that's just moved to the town and is kind of, you know, he was a good athlete in his old school. His mother has recently died from cancer, and he's kind of, his dad has moved him and his sister away because his father couldn't handle being in the same town as where he, you know, loved his wife and everything. We've got Aunt Greg, who's Annie's sister. She's kind of like, you know, she's a cheerleader type. And then we have Nancy, who is basically a real nice girl who Greg meets when he moves into town and everything. We've got Brian Foster, who's the kid, he's like an all-state athlete, who he's actually the character who is the person that's murdered in the story, but his story kind of resonates throughout because he kind of affects the whole story. And then we've got the high school quarterback, Blake, and some of his friends. So that's pretty much the cast at this point. It's like an ensemble, you know.
It seems like a nice, well-rounded group. I mean, the quarterback character Blake, he's pretty stereotypical.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. I think they all fit. You know, they wouldn't be stereotypical. You know, I think a lot of times people fit that description because exists in high school. You know.
Absolutely. Yeah. You were talking about things. 80s films and The Breakfast Club and. You know, and they are that way for a reason. They did, you know, resonate with real life a bit.
Yeah.
How would you describe the brother and sister relationship between Greg and Annie? Is it going to be really like they rely on each other, or is it going to be just constant rivalry and they resent each other? What's the dynamic?
I think at this point they've been through a lot together. So I think, you know, losing their mom and trying to deal with their dad, and they're close in age, you know, they're a couple grades apart, so they're close enough in age where they deal with each other, but at the same time, it's like, you know, anytime you're around, I think when siblings get to high school, I think there's that feeling of, God, get out of my way, especially from the younger one, you know, because you're always dealing with this, and this is her chance, I think this is a good chance for her to start fresh, you know, because this isn't Greg's high school now, who's Greg's her brother, who's a senior. So, like, it's almost like she gets to come to the school and kind of be her own. No one, she's not Greg's little sister here.
Right.
So I think, as much as they're not rivals, I think they definitely, there's opportunities there for both of them for their relationship to change, where a lot of times when you grow up in the same town and grow up through there and you're the younger one, you're always going to be Greg's little sister. Or, you know, that's
especially if you're, if your older brother or sister is very popular.
Yeah, and he was, at his old school, he was a smart kid, popular, was a high school football player and all that stuff. So, yeah, definitely.
You have that shadow to deal with.
Yeah.
As far as if we were going to, you know, we're here to promote the pack, so what would be the target audience? Like, who in the retail shops could we say, could we point this out to? Like, if you already buy this, then this is the sort of book that you, you know, you should put on your pre-order list. Who,
right.
You know, which buyers are we looking for here?
I guess we talked about this a little bit before, and I think you know, if you're into like the high school relationship stuff and like, you know, but like the violence, I would almost say like it's kind of like a horror version of Invincible, maybe, where you get a little bit of that angle. I'm not sure if there's a lot of, I'm trying to think of other horror books that deal with like teenagers, and that's kind of what I think of, just because of the, you know, like Invincible had that uber violence angle too. Which is a lot of fun, you know, but it also deals a lot with relationships, and that's kind of what we wanted to do with the pack, is like have those relationships and then throw, you know, have that John Hughes film and then throw a vicious werewolf killer in the middle of it and see what happens. So hopefully that's kind of what we get. Obviously Invincible's a good one because it sells a lot of copies.
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody
that buys Invincible should be pre-ordering.
Yeah, just pick it up. As a matter of fact, retailers, just put it in their pull it for them.
Right.
they'll love it. So.
Okay, so we are, is everything ready to go? Like,
we're in the middle of the third issue now with the art, so we're just about wrapped up. The first and second issue are done, so just a matter of finishing up the third one. We wanted to make sure we kind of had enough had the first and second issue so we could go monthly and make sure it was good to go.
On time?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. Especially with October, because we wanted to make sure we hit, you know, we wanted to get it out there. And I know it's stupid, all the horror books come out on Halloween, but we definitely wanted to kind of get on the shelves in time for people to, you know, when they're in the mood for something scary, maybe to give it a chance.
No, I think that's great. I think that's a perfect time.
Yeah.
Perfect time to do it. Do you think it's going to be lost in the shuffle with all of the giant DC relaunching of stuff?
It's a lot. I mean, we're, you know, hopefully everyone, you know, goes real low with their second issue orders and picks up the first issue of the pack.
I'm wondering how many people are just going to give up on, you know, mainstream out of frustration at this point.
It's hard. I think, I know as a reader now with me, like, and this is just me, like, just, I know, because I've been reading, you know, I've been reading them since I was 9 or 10 years, like a long time, like 25 years reading comics. And it's just, I do enjoy the indie books now because I know I'm looking for, I'm looking for a complete story now. And I love the mainstream stuff. I grew up on it. You know, I was a big fan. X-Men, my favorite book was X-Men growing up, and I got to be on the editorial team of the X-Men. I got to help start Exiles, help start, you know, work on a bunch of books, and I do think, you know, I do now, I think, enjoy the indie experience a little more, but I do appreciate, like, I still do collect some of the mainstream books. I still get, like, Uncanny X-Force and things like that that kind of, like, remind me of what I loved about the books as a kid, you know, that, that idea that anything could happen, so.
So let's, we're just going to diverge from the pack for just a moment because there's so much comic news right now. So in the last week, there's been an uproar about Ultimate Spider-Man.
Right.
Is now like a, you know, an interracial character. He's
right.
He's like, I guess, half Hispanic and half black.
Yeah, I saw that.
Do you think it's like, you know, do you think this is too shocking because Spider-Man should be Peter Parker and that's at the end, no more?
No, I mean, Spider-Man's been other people before. You know, I mean, we've had Ben Reilly, we've had a lot of things. I mean, it's funny that people are in such, oddly enough, in comic book world, it's more likely that Spider-Man will be a clone than it would be a black Hispanic dude. You know, I think that's what's funny is, like, that's, you know, it's okay to clone, that makes sense. Black Hispanic dude, I just don't know. But I think everyone's going to be fine with it, and I know they'll do a good job with it. I know Brian Bendis seems really passionate about it, and, you know. Sometimes I wish didn't always feel like a stunt. I wish it felt, you know, I'm sure they're going to fix it. They're going to write in a way that is like, feels very natural, you know. It's hard when you just see the end result, which is kind of them throwing us this Morales character and stuff, and you're like, oh, it's just a dude in a suit. But, like, the reason we all love Spider-Man is we got to see his journey into the suit, and I'm thinking they're going to do the same with this guy, and by the end of it, I'm sure we'll be just as, you know, it'll be just as cool. And for some kids, you know, this will be who Spider-Man is, hopefully. You know, I think that's the goal. I think it's interesting when you can look at a character and see yourself in him a little bit more.
We did. I mean, we had a change in Captain America. We had a change in Batman. So, you know, I guess.
And I like both of those. Both those stories are great. You know, I think people just, you know, I think sometime soon, hopefully, we can all just look at whoever, whatever the race is, and just be like, oh, there's a new character in the suit. Not like...
It might have been less charming if he was like an alien with green skin or an alien with blue skin.
Yeah, just like, you know, sometimes I wonder, like, you know, what the issue is at that point, if you're worried about that, you know. But I think they'll do a good job. But they always do nice, you know, they do good stuff, so...
Well, where can people find you at conventions to ask you questions about the pack or any of the other projects that you're on, like the Stuff of Legends?
I will be at Baltimore in August. I think I'm going to be at Ithacon in Ithaca, New York. That's one near me. It's a one-day show. And I'm planning on going to New York. And in New York, I believe I'll be at the, you know, and I'll be at Baltimore, New York, I'll be at the Third World booth. So that's basically the plan. And I believe at Baltimore we'll have a con edition of the pack for people, a black and white edition. So, which should be fun.
Okay.
This is a really small print, like, you know, just to get the book out there, let retailers see it and show some people. So.
Okay. It is in this month's previews on page 318. It's the pack. It's the first issue out of the three parts. So, definitely check it out. Give Third World your love. We do love those guys.
Please do.
All right, Mike, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Amber.
Where can people find you online as well?
I'm usually just on Twitter or Facebook. So that's pretty, if you just look up Mike Rach on Twitter or Facebook, you can find me. I'm lame with my, I don't have a site or anything, but I'm more than happy to talk in any of those spots. And if you really need to get a hold of me, you can always just, if you email Third World, they'll get whatever, any questions or anything you need from me. But I'm pretty easy to get a hold of on those two spots.
Fantastic. So it's at Mike Rach on Twitter. And you can find me at Elizabeth Amber on Twitter as well, or amberunmasked.com. So until next time, thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.